Good evening and welcome. This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Ken Miller, Associate Editor at Las Vegas Weekly, and I'm joined tonight by Josh Bell, Entertainment Writer at Large and frequent contributor to the Weekly. And basically what we're talking about tonight is, I think, what's on everyone's mind, Super 8, and more specifically, J.J. Abrams and his appeal to the masses.
Yeah, Super 8, I think, is definitely the most anticipated movie release that's coming up this week. People are excited about about seeing it, and I'm excited about seeing it, too. I haven't gotten to see it yet. We're recording this early, but by the time you hear this, I will have already been excited about seeing the movie.
Full disclosure, we're taping this about an hour before Josh is about to see this movie, so he's very
giddy
excited.
With anticipation.
Yes.
I think what's cool about Super 8, regardless of how it turns out, just the idea of this big summer blockbuster movie with the same amount of hype and anticipation and excitement as stuff like Green Lantern and X-Men and Transformers and things like that. That's an original story. That's not a franchise. It's not based on an existing comic book or an old TV show. It's not a remake. It's an actual original idea by J.J. Abrams, who has hopefully an exciting personal vision for this movie. And that to me is what's cool, is that I think is something that we've lost in Hollywood movies a little bit, that everything has to be pre-tested in some way. It has to be a guaranteed property that the studio knows people are familiar with in some way in order for it to be a movie at this level. And this is not that. And it's just the property here, in a way, is J.J. Abrams himself, because he does have this fan following, and people are excited to see what he does, even if they don't know anything about it, and kind of especially if they don't know anything about it, in a way, because that's been his MO in a lot of the stuff that he's done, is this level of secrecy and the level of excitement he can create by holding things back, by not telling you what's going on, and having the audience be in a frenzy wondering, what is this about? And you get these little glimpses. I mean, in the trailers for this movie, you just get these quick flashes of things and you think, what is happening here? I can't wait to find out, which is cool, and which is something you don't get a lot in movies anymore.
I was thinking that this trailer itself is almost kind of a lost art, in that, you know, so many trailers I see nowadays, I feel like I've seen the movie after I watch the trailer.
Right.
And this one, every time I see a trailer, I just want to see the movie more and more, even though I have no idea what's going on or what it's about.
And that's what a trailer should do, I think. It should entice you into the theater without necessarily giving you every plot point and every single element of the movie, so that there's nothing to surprise you or excite you when you get there. So yeah, I mean, Abrams is a great storyteller, but I think he's also really good at marketing, and he's done that with this movie, with other movies he's worked on. He's the writer and director on Super 8 and other projects. He's just been a producer, but things like Cloverfield or even going back to Lost on TV, I mean, so much of the appeal for Lost for years was, oh my God, what's going to happen next? We don't know. It's constantly surprising. It's constantly unexpected. And that's what keeps people coming back to stuff like that.
Yeah, his talent. I mean, I was just looking at a brief search of what he's been involved in, and I had forgotten that he was involved with Felicity.
Yeah, and I love Felicity, actually. I mean, Felicity doesn't, none of these descriptions really apply to Felicity. I mean, that was not a plot-driven TV show, really, in any way. I mean, there was an issue of, will Felicity choose Noel or Ben, but I don't think that was really on the same level of, what is the island, or, you know, what is this monster that's ravaging
New York
City?
Well, hey, you have to start somewhere, right?
Right, exactly. And I think maybe I have read there was a profile of J.J. Abrams in the New York Times like a week or two ago that was interesting, and talked about how he felt very limited with what was going on in Felicity, and the way that the show Alias, which was the next show that he created, came about was his sort of musing about, well, what if Felicity came home from spring break or something, and it turned out that she was a secret agent, and all of a sudden she had to choose between Noel and Ben, but she also had to go on these missions, and that kind of was a catalyst for what he did next. But I think you look at Felicity, and I, again, I love Felicity. I think that's a great show in terms of the pantheon of teen dramas or whatever. I think Abrams and Matt Reeves, who worked on that closely with him and was the director of Cloverfield, did a really good job of making you involved in the lives of those characters. And I think going past that to where he's done this more genre stuff and blockbuster movies or special effects driven things or stuff with a lot of action, he's always kept that grounded in the lives of the characters, and you care about their relationships and things like that. And that goes all the way back to Felicity.
Yeah, that, it seems like a general theme throughout all his work is that he really cares about backstory. He cares about, you know, making you care about the characters you see on screen.
Yeah.
And what I love about this man's career so far is that a lot of people would look at Lost as almost the pinnacle of any other career. And it's almost like Abrams is just getting started because, I mean, you know, we still have Fringe on TV.
Yeah.
The time being anyway. Yeah. I know there's
well,
talk
there's one more season on the way at least. So, and that's pretty good.
But I mean, then you also have, you know, what he did to Star Trek.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, there's people on both sides, but I mean, personally, I thought it was fantastic and I can't wait to see more.
Yeah, I agree. I loved the Star Trek movie. And yeah, I mean, the thing about Lost is, and a lot of the TV stuff that he's worked on as he's become more and more involved with movies and as he's just sort of had his fingers in a lot of projects. I mean, the driving force behind Lost as it went forward was really more Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, who were the executive producers for most of the run. And Abrams was involved early on and with the first season, but then he was able to sort of hand this off to these other people who were very capable and very talented, and I think probably took some lessons from the way that Abrams approaches things and were able to run the show on their own and put their own stamp on it. And you know, their contributions to Lost are extremely important. I mean, probably more important than what Abrams did to just get things going. And this is the same thing with Fringe. J.H. Wyman and Jeff Pinkner, who are the producers, the showrunners on that, do really cool, amazing stuff that I don't know how much of that was envisioned by J.J. Abrams when the show was first created. But I mean, I think he's one of the talents of a producer, whether it's a TV producer or a movie producer, is being able to find the right people to work with and give them the freedom to do exciting, interesting stuff and trust them to make that happen. And it seems to me like that's what's happened, especially with Lost and with Fringe on TV.
He's been a wonderful, you know, facilitator for up-and-coming talent. I mean, a lot of people who are big in the business right now are probably that way because they've given their start by Abrams.
Right, and he's got a couple shows that are coming up in the upcoming TV season that are the same way that he's probably even less involved. I know at least on Fringe and on Lost, he's credited as one of the co-creators. And I think on these shows, he's merely an executive producer. But there's on CBS, there's a show called Person of Interest with Jim Caviezel that's coming up in the fall, which was created by Jonathan Nolan, the brother of Christopher Nolan, the filmmaker behind The Dark Knight and Batman Begins and a lot of cool stuff. And Abrams is the executive producer of that, but it seems exactly like he's sort of facilitating the vision of someone else and being able to kind of move that along and have the J.J. Abrams name on it that'll get people interested and understand it's a certain kind of approach with the mythology and the mysteries and whatnot, but someone else's vision. And then Alcatraz, which is going to be on Fox, not until midseason, so probably not until January or so. But that's a couple of former Lost writers who are now working on their own show, and he's sort of helping shepherd that. And it's very much about the mystical stuff and mysteries and whatnot. And I think hopefully those will both be interesting.
I mean, is it too much of a reach to kind of suggest that he's the next Spielberg? I mean, you know, his putting his stamp on these projects, just, you know, I mean, Spielberg at one point was also doing a lot of TV, and, you know, anything he put his stamp on was, you know, was doing pretty well.
Yeah. Well, I think Abrams clearly, I mean, especially with Super 8, again, I haven't seen it yet, but from the way it looks in the trailers and just from the way that he's talked about it, he's obviously extremely influenced by especially early Spielberg movies, stuff like E.T., Close Encounters of the Third Kind, The Goonies, which was not a Spielberg-directed movie, but I'm pretty sure Spielberg produced.
He was involved, yeah.
And Spielberg is a producer on Super 8. So, yeah, obviously, I mean, I think it's maybe a stretch at this point to say oh, he's going to be the next Spielberg. I mean, who's one of the most significant American filmmakers of all time. I mean, that's a big, those are big shoes to fill. And of course, Spielberg went on from stuff like E.T. and Close Encounters to do very serious Oscar-winning movies, stuff like Schindler's List and Amistad and Saving Private Ryan. And I don't know if we're going to get J.J. Abrams' version of Schindler's List or Saving Private Ryan. And I don't know if I necessarily want that or would like that, but who knows? I mean, certainly he's established himself as a sort of a mogul and as we're saying, a mentor for younger, whether it's filmmakers or TV creators. And in that sense, sure, he could be the next Spielberg.
Well, I mean, I guess I want to ask you, Josh, I mean, you are very well familiar with all of his work. I mean, what do you think, what has been the key to his success primarily? I mean, what do you see in his work that has led to him being so widely accepted and actually, you know, we can argue changing the zeitgeist even?
Well, I mean, I think it's some of the things that we talked about. I think it's that focus on characters and on relationships. And I know that was one of the things that some people were frustrated with at the end of Lost, that the show seemed to be more concerned with the character relationships than it was with all of these big mythological questions that people were hoping to be answered. But I think the balance between character and the big mythological stuff is very important, and it's something that a lot of big Hollywood productions and TV shows as well kind of tend to forget. And I think the marketing aspect, what we're talking about with Super 8 and stuff that happened with Cloverfield and with Lost, that the way that you can create that sense of giddiness in your audience, like, oh my God, what is this about? What is going to happen? I can't wait to find out. And people are so jaded. I mean, and justifiably so in a lot of cases. To be able to generate that feeling is really something. And to combine those two is what makes him successful.
What you say about marketing, though, that it's absolutely true, because I still remember when I saw the marketing, the previews for Lost. Mm-hmm. At the time, I firmly thought this was some kind of Survivor ripoff where they were doing like a drama, you know, basically of these people just landing on an island and learning to live with each other. Had no clue as to what was going on. And that's because they hid their secret very well.
Yeah.
And then from the very beginning, it completely took you off guard. I mean, you had no idea what was going on. And I think that's why people kept turning in, because, you know, they were caught on, you know, unaware, and it kind of jolted them out of their jaded state. And I think Abrams is good at that. And Cloverfield as well. I mean, Cloverfield wasn't a huge box office hit, but it was, but I went to see it. I mean, I was very interested by the previews, you know, had a pretty good idea of what it was about, but still the way he marketed it, it was still one of those, you've got to get to the theater and check this out. You have to see this.
Right. And Cloverfield, I think, did well considering, I don't think it was a huge budget movie. I mean, it didn't have any name stars in it. And
they're working on a sequel, right?
They're supposed to be working on a sequel, although I think it's kind of on the back burner. I mean, Matt Reeves, who directed Cloverfield, is busy. He's got some projects. He directed Let Me In afterwards, and I think he's got a few other things in the works. And obviously, Abrams is busy with a million things, including Super 8 and two new TV shows and the Star Trek sequel. And Drew Goddard, who wrote Cloverfield, I think he has some other stuff that he's working on as well. So whether they'll get to that sequel or not, I don't know. But I mean, on its own, I think, yeah, it was quite successful, especially given that it wasn't a movie budgeted on the scale of something like Transformers or a big superhero movie where it has to make just an obscene amount of money just to break even.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but wasn't he also involved in one of the Mission Impossible movies?
Yeah, that was the first movie he directed, was Mission Impossible 3, which I enjoyed too. I mean, I don't think that's a great movie necessarily or the pinnacle of what Abrams has done, but I think it was entertaining and it was a good addition to that franchise. So yeah, I mean, and it was probably a good way for him to kind of get his start and have experience directing a movie of that scale that he then was able to take into doing Star Trek and into doing Super 8. And if he directs the Star Trek sequel, which he's still not said whether he's going to do or not, but I'm sure that was definitely a contributor to his being able to do all that stuff later on.
Mm-hmm. Wow. A lot to think about. Well, one of the things I wanted to also speak to you about tonight for our listeners is the upcoming CineKink.
Yes.
And first of all, maybe if you could just kind of explain to our listeners what that is.
CineKink is, it's a film festival that takes place in New York. It calls itself the Kinky Film Festival. So it's movies that deal with sex and sexuality, sometimes in an explicit way. I mean, it's definitely geared towards an adult audience, and it's geared toward embracing all range of sexual expression.
Like for example, like what do you mean?
I mean, things from alternative BDSM kind of stuff and fetishy, kinky kind of things, sex work, pornography, any kind of subject matter like that that you might think is sort of taboo is definitely something that they embrace in a serious way and also in a playful way. And the festival itself, the main festival, takes place in New York, and there's a touring version that goes around the country, and that sort of smaller scale touring version is going to be here this weekend at Theater 7 downtown.
What is the goal of the festival? I mean, are they just trying to, you know, kind of get the word out, you know, more exposure for this, you know, aspect of film? Or, I mean, what exactly is the stated goal of this?
I think like any film festival, the goal is to show some good movies. And last year the tour came here, played at the Onyx Theater, and there was some good stuff. I mean, I think like any film festival, there's a mix of good stuff and kind of not so good stuff. And I think partially too, it's to show that this kind of material can be celebrated and can be exciting and can be fun. It doesn't have to be dirty or taboo. And I appreciate that. I mean, I think the filmmaking is good, and I think their attitude towards sexuality is also very refreshing, and it's cool that it comes to town.
Well, you've been to this in the past. Like, describe for our readers some of the types of films that you've seen that you remember.
I know one thing that you were curious about is at last year's festival, and they're not doing that this year, there was an actual program of excerpts from real hardcore pornography, which was sort of strange to watch in a theater with film fans or whatever. But I think it's interesting. The idea there is to show that there's artistry and there's filmmaking craft in this stuff as well, which is totally true. And I'm not sure why that program isn't part of this year's festival, but there's movies that are funny.
Were people kind of squirming in their seats when that happened?
I think they were a little, but then you just sit there and you get used to it. And it's just, it definitely challenges your idea of what it is to watch a movie like that, because you don't traditionally think of that as a movie that you would sit in a theater with your clothes on and be watching.
Although I guess you could argue if you're already in that theater at this festival, you realize that sort of thing is possible.
Well, sure. I mean, people are definitely more open. And if you're not, then you wouldn't go to a festival like this, because even the non-hardcore movies do have a lot of nudity and a lot of sex. And that's what they're all about.
Is the main point of these films titillation, or is it more to tell a good story?
I think, other than the hardcore stuff, which is mainly about arousal, I think generally the movies that they have here, it's the point of any movie. If it's a comedy, it's trying to be funny, it's trying to be entertaining, it's trying to make you think, it's trying to tell you an interesting story or illuminate something. There's documentary films in here as well. I think the thing is that they're looking for good filmmaking regardless, and it just happens to have this subject matter. And some of them are really heavily about sexuality, and some of them just feature that as one element. So, yeah, it's a fun festival. I hope people check it out. And Theater 7 is a cool venue downtown that's doing a lot of things like this now. They've got other little festivals and traveling things that are coming later on this year. And I will be on a panel as part of this festival, a panel on sex and cinema on Saturday at 6 p.m. And that's free. So if you want to hear me blab some more about stuff, you can come check that out.
I understand that one of our other freelancers will be with you.
Oh, yes. And that's true. Lynn Camella, who is a professor at UNLV and is also the sex columnist for The Weekly, will be part of that panel. Along with Lisa Vandiver, who is the director of the Cinekink Festival and one of the filmmakers in the festival as well. So it should be interesting.
Is this the first time that you have done a panel for that?
For this festival, yeah. They had a panel last year. I think Lynn was on the panel last year. I was not, but yeah, I've done festival panels before, so hopefully they won't throw too many curveballs at me.
And when again is the festival from? From when?
It's June 10th through 12th. It's Friday through Sunday. Mostly Saturday is the big day. It's pretty much all day Saturday, and it's at Theater 7, which is downtown in the Arts District on 3rd Street.
Yes, you want to check it out. And Josh, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We've really enjoyed having you.
Always a pleasure to be here.
welcome back. This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. I'm Ken Miller, Associate Editor at Las Vegas Weekly. Joining me now is staff writer Erin Ryan. And Erin has had a very interesting experience over the weekend that she would love to talk to you about. But first of all, I'd like to kind of go into detail about who Erin is. She just recently joined us, and I'm going to let her fill in the rest. So, Erin, where are you from and when did you join us?
I moved here from Boise, Idaho a little more than a month ago, and have since had a crazy immersion into the Las Vegas Valley life. And that immersion took the shape of a minor league baseball game on Friday, the 51s.
You saw your first 51s game.
I did. And it was an enlightening and enthralling experience filled with junk food and crazy people and some good baseball, actually.
Now, I have to ask, what made you want to go to see a 51s game as opposed to, you know, some of the other sports we have here in town?
Well, in Boise, we actually have a minor league team as well called the Hawks, and it was just always such a fun thing to go on a random night and buy a cheap ticket and, you know, sit and drink expensive beer, which balanced out the cheap ticket. And
there is nothing like beer at a ballpark.
It's true. And even not knowing a lot about baseball, it's just one of those things that's so American, it's so easy to enjoy. And you just sort of feel like you're part of your community at a baseball game. It's weird, but you're sitting there with all these people and, you know, you're standing for the national anthem and the seventh inning stretch and singing, you know, Take Me Out to the Ball Game. And it's all very, I think it's nostalgic for people. Even if they're not into baseball, there's just something about it that feels really old school. So mm-hmm. I wanted to check out the scene here and see what it was like.
Now, what was the reaction when you told people you were thinking of going?
You know, I heard a few things. One person told me that it was going to be pretty ghetto. You know, it was kind of in a bad part of town, and the stadium was sort of run down, hadn't been renovated, you know, in a long time, and didn't really paint a rosy picture. Told me that the food wasn't very good, and, you know, I just was imagining kind of regretting my decision. But it's like seeing a movie. You never know what people's taste is. It can be the night, the mood they're in. I don't know, astrology, whatever. Like, maybe your horoscope told you not to go, but you did. So I just wanted to see for myself, and I found that it was a very different picture than the one that was painted.
I have to say I agree. I've been to a few games there, too. My wife and I actually purchased a season package at one point.
Oh, wow.
When they were
the commitment.
when they were the Los Angeles Dodgers. Those were the days.
Right on.
But they are now the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yes.
Still great baseball. But I guess I wanted to kind of tell our listeners, maybe people who are new to town or people who have been here a while but have just never, you know, gone to see a game for whatever reason, I just kind of want you to kind of give them an idea of what their, you know, what experience they'll have.
For sure. Well, walking into the stadium, it's really airy and breezy. That was kind of my main first impression, was just the openness of it, which I think is great for this climate because it's going to be really hot and crazy. And there's a nice big section in the center where you're actually under shade. And we were sitting there, it was about 80 degrees, just a warm breeze blowing through. It was like the perfect night for a baseball game. And the field is actually in really good condition. It's very green, and that may just be because the spring has been really gentle this year. But it looks really good, you know. And
that is one thing I wanted to let the listeners know. Because of the weather, they're all night games, which is actually a very nice thing. I mean, I've been to a lot of day games, like in Los Angeles. Yeah. Not so nice. So.
Yeah, it could be like the death ray at a certain hotel that will remain nameless when the sun is shining directly on your thighs. But anyway, I thought it all looked really good. There were a ton of people, a lot of bustle, and it was just a great people watching venue.
A lot of kids?
A ton of kids, and a lot of them were wearing little baseball uniforms. I think, you know, play in the Pee Wee League. And there were two sort of grassy knolls on either side of the baseball diamond, and it was just mayhem of kids rolling and playing catch, and just, it was really good to see kids being active, you know, even though they weren't watching the game so much. And I mean, there was cotton candy and Philly steak sandwiches and giant hot dogs, like enough to feed a family of four with cheese and everything. And
And you ate all this?
I didn't eat all of that. The first thing I got was a box of Cracker Jack. And it isn't Cracker Jack's, just so everyone knows, it's Cracker Jack singular.
That's that, just like the song says.
Exactly. There you go. And it's a classic. And I think the only reason it's still around is baseball, because it's in the song and they sell it at every game, I'm pretty sure, across the country. And it's delicious. It's basically caramel corn and nuts covered in the same caramel. And there's always a prize inside. My prize was a pencil topper that had a fun fact about graphite. And I thought that was cool because it was like information and a cool like takeaway.
These are the tiny moments at a baseball game you take away, right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So I started with that. I had a Bud Light filled on the bottoms up beer machine. And if you guys haven't seen
this. Oh, yeah. Describe that for the, I don't think a lot of people know about
this. It is the coolest thing ever. And I heard a rumor that it was actually invented by an engineering student at UNLV. I don't know if that's true. That was what Blue, the guy who was serving the beer, said. And essentially you have this platform and it has these four metal things on it. And there are these specially made plastic cups that have magnets. And you push the cup down on top of one of the metal prongs, and the beer fills it from the bottom up to the perfect level. It's faster than anything you've ever seen. And I think it can fill, what's the figure? It's like 44 pints. I can't remember the amount of time, but it's faster than you would ever be able to do on a regular tap. And you might not think it sounds very amazing, but every person that ordered a beer was just like, wow, you
know? Well, there's one reason right there to go. You get to see this really cool device.
It is the coolest.
I mean, you're going to go get a beer anyway.
Exactly. And if you're going to pay an arm and a leg for a beer, it might as well be a bottoms up beer. That's super cool.
So when you're done drinking this, what happens to the magnet?
A lot of people take them home and stick them on the fridge or, you know, in the junk drawer with all the other magnets.
So you have a nice little souvenir. As well. So.
Exactly. But I will say that you have to be careful how you hold the cup, because people are really accustomed to putting their fingers on the bottom, and you can actually pop out the magnet and beer. It can be a very bad situation.
Okay.
So gingerly handle your magnetized beer cup.
I will remember that.
Yeah.
So how about did you try the hot dogs there?
We tried, I should say. Thankfully, there were multiple people eating this thing because it was huge. It was a foot-long hot dog. And you can choose between grated and melted cheese. And I would definitely stick with the grated because you know it's actually cheese. The melted, you never really know. And plus, it just sounds gross. I don't know, melted cheese on a hot dog. So we did grated cheddar and ketchup. And I'm actually a mustard fan, but it gives you really heinous breath. So we just stuck with the ketchup and cheese.
So it sounds like the food is pretty awesome. So how about the game itself? Like what kind of entertainment were you offered between innings?
You know, there were some fun little demos with the mascot. I think his name is Cosmo.
Cosmo.
He's an alien, obviously with Area 51, making that connection there. And they had a little kid's school choir, you know, singing, and there was one kid who sang the same note the entire song, which was so cute. And just the game itself was actually really fun to watch. There were some really great plays. There was a pickle between first and second base. There was, you know, lots of pop flies.
You gotta love pickles.
Home runs back to back. It was good sauce.
So I have to ask, I'm almost nervous about asking, did the 51s win this game?
They didn't win the game, but honestly, there were so many great plays that they did make, and everybody was really behind them and cheering for them anyway, and they won me over.
Well,
so.
And of course, the best part about this all, folks, is that if you go, you could be seeing the stars of tomorrow. I mean, these guys are one
for
injury
sure.
away from joining, you know, the major league team. Well, Aaron, thank you very much. That was a lot of fun. And I hope that our listeners try to attend their first 51s game. I think you're going to really enjoy it. That's going to do it for us here at Las Vegas Weekly. Thank you for joining us.